From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, allegations the IRS inappropriately scrutinised right-wing non-profits let fly on Capitol Hill.
We cannot tell the American people that we have done all we can do to get to the truth in this investigation if we offer a pass to a critical witness like Ms. Lerner.
We're in New York as the UN votes to send peacekeeping troops into the Central African Republic. Hot topic, the chili sauce that's been branded a public nuisance. And heir to the Late Show throne, Letterman's replacement is announced.
He's, I think, very similar to Letterman. Their sense of humor kind of fit together. They're just these very kind of quirky, sarcastic personalities. People seem to think it's a good choice.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. Russian President Vladimir Putin has warned European leaders Moscow may cut its supply of natural gas to Ukraine if a conflict over late payments is not resolved. If the supply chain is threatened, other parts of Europe could face a gas scarcity. The situation in eastern Ukraine is growing increasingly tense as pro-Russian activists that have seized and barricaded themselves inside government buildings call for Moscow to send in troops to protect them. Daria Bondarchuk has the latest from Moscow.
Activists continue to build barricades near the government buildings in the eastern cities of Donetsk and Lugansk, preparing for a possible attack by Ukrainian army forces reportedly sent in by the interim government. Early on Wednesday, the acting interior minister of Ukraine, Arseniy Avakov, said the situation in eastern Ukraine will be stabilized within 48 hours. Media reports and amateur videos surfacing on the internet show military trucks, armored personnel carriers, and tanks gathering near the city of Donetsk.
It's the 50th anniversary of the U.S. Civil Rights Act of 1964, which outlawed discrimination based on race, sex, or religion. President Barack Obama paid tribute to President Lyndon B. Johnson, who fought to get the landmark legislation passed in the face of fierce congressional opposition. President Obama said he wouldn't be where he is today without laws like the Civil Rights Act. But he also said America has a debt to pay those who face discrimination and said the country still needs improvement. Mr. Obama said the fight for equal rights must continue.
Our rights, our freedoms, they are not given. They must be won. They must be nurtured through struggle and discipline and persistence and faith.
During his murder trial, South African Paralympian Oscar Pistorius continues to face a grueling cross-examination, as the prosecution portrays him as a liar who keeps changing his story to suit the defense. Mr. Pistorius reiterated that he had not murdered, but accidentally shot and killed girlfriend Reva Steenkamp. But well-known prosecutor Gary Nell said Mr. Pistorius was selfish and cruel to Ms. Steenkamp in the months leading up to the incident. Comedian Stephen Colbert, star of The Colbert Report on the Comedy Central Network, has been tapped to take over from David Letterman as host of the well-known Late Show on the network CBS. Last week, Mr. Letterman announced his retirement after 21 years with CBS. The move is the latest in a recent series of late-night television shakeups in which a new generation of presenters has emerged. From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. The United Nations Security Council has approved sending a full peacekeeping force to the Central African Republic following a year of religious-motivated violence. Thousands have been killed during fighting between Christian and Muslim groups, with the UN estimating 1.36 million people, nearly a third of the population, is in need of assistance. Officials in the U.S. state of Pennsylvania say they are trying to find a motive for the mass stabbing that took place at an American high school on Wednesday. A 16-year-old male student is accused of carrying out the stabbings, wounding nearly two dozen people at a school in the town of Murraysville, outside Pittsburgh. Rebecca Hume reports.
Police in Murraysville say they haven't yet found a motive for Wednesday's attack. Sophomore student Alex Haribal is accused of carrying out the double knife attack at the Franklin Regional High School. A lawyer for the family told US media the 16-year-old student did not have any psychiatric or disciplinary problems. His family have described him as a student who mingled well with others. Alex Rebel is charged with 4 counts of attempted homicide and 21 counts of assault. He is expected to face a preliminary court hearing in the next 7 to 10 days.
and the Russian government declined to give the FBI information on one of the Boston Marathon bombing suspects 2 years before the attack, details which could potentially have led to more extensive scrutiny of him. That's according to a new report by the Inspector General of the Intelligence Community. It found that Russia declined several requests for further information about Tamerlan Tsarnaev. Kate Fisher reports from Washington.
Russian officials told the FBI in 2011 that Tamerlan Tsarnaev was a follower of radical Islam and that he had changed drastically since 2010 as he prepared to join unspecified underground groups in Russia. But it was only after the bombing last April that Moscow shared additional intelligence with the FBI, including information from an intercepted phone conversation between Tsarnaev and his mother, in which they discussed Islamic Jihad. At the time, American law enforcement officers believed Tsarnaev posed a greater threat to Russia.
And that's the latest Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. The partisan war over allegations the Internal Revenue Service inappropriately scrutinised right-wing non-profits escalated on Capitol Hill today. A powerful oversight committee voted 21-12 to hold former IRS official Lois Lerner in contempt because she refused twice to testify about the agency's actions. Republican leaders have also demanded the US Justice Department investigate whether Lerner violated any criminal statutes. Our correspondent Alice Olstein has the story from the Capitol.
A nearly four-hour hearing on Capitol Hill ended with a vote to hold a mid-level bureaucrat at the IRS in contempt for invoking her Fifth Amendment right to remain silent when called to testify before the committee. Republicans argued Tuesday that Lois Lerner waived her constitutional rights by giving a short statement before refusing to answer questions. But the committee's ranking member, Elijah Cummings, disagreed.
I do not believe that the Founding Fathers, when giving a person the right not to incriminate themselves, the thing that they did not want was a gotcha situation. In other words, we need to err on the side when it comes to rights, making sure that people's rights are upheld.
Cummings said he's also worried the contempt vote and Wednesday night's criminal referral on the IRS scandal will have a chilling effect on the agency's work going forward.
I think people can become fearful. Employees can become fearful that they don't do the job they're supposed to do.
Other lawmakers, including Virginia Democrat George Connolly, who called the hearing a shameful moment for Congress, expressed similar concerns. He told FSN it's important to understand the factors that contributed to the IRS adopting inappropriate shortcuts when reviewing applications from political organizations.
First of all, we have a Republican majority in the House that has consistently slashed IRS budget funding so that they don't have the requisite resources to do their job. And as a result, by the way, we leave $380 billion of taxes owed the government on the table every year uncollected, to say nothing of the resources necessary after the flood of applications from a terrible Supreme Court ruling, Citizens United, that IRS simply wasn't equipped to handle it, so they created bad filters.
An Inspector General investigation last year found the number of 501c4 political nonprofit applications nearly doubled between 2009 and 2012, and IRS officials flagged groups for extra review if their name included the words Tea Party or Patriot, among other terms. Documents released in January show the agency also scrutinized groups that use the words progressive, marijuana, and occupy. Committee Chair and California Democrat Darrell Issa said Thursday that his committee has an obligation to force Lerner to testify and turn over her private emails related to the case.
We cannot tell the American people that we have done all we can do to get to the truth in this investigation if we offer a pass to a critical witness like Ms. Lerner.
As the IRS dispute continues, lawmakers on both sides of the aisle are looking to the upcoming November elections, in which political nonprofit organizations are expected to play a major role. Lisa Gilbert with the watchdog group Public Citizen explained that under current law, groups can dedicate half their time and money to electoral activity, such as producing ads attacking a candidate, and still qualify as a tax-exempt nonprofit.
If you are a 501c4, if you are a social welfare group, donors, either corporate donors or sort of big moneyed millionaire donors, can pour millions into those entities, and then there's no required donor disclosure. You know, sort of the groups that are trying to find loopholes aggressively interpret the tax rules and use them to have millions of dollars funneled into campaigns without disclosure.
As Republicans accused the IRS Thursday of scrutinizing these groups too much, Connolly and other lawmakers say they're worried they aren't being reviewed enough.
We're handing out these tax exemptions to organizations who primarily are social welfare organizations, and we all know the fiction. No, they're not. They're primarily right-wing, partisan, political fronts promoting their agenda. That's not illegal, but you're not entitled to a tax-exempt status under the law.
Following the scandal in Congress and Inspector General report last year, the IRS began writing new rules to set clear definitions of what is political activity and how much of it is appropriate for a nonprofit social welfare organization. But the rules likely will not be in place by the midterm elections. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
This is FSN Reports. It's a process that's taken 5 years, but the outcome has left civil rights groups far from satisfied. According to New York Times sources, the Justice Department's revision of racial profiling rules will give the FBI the green light to continue with the majority of its current tactics. Those controversial methods, many of which came about in the aftermath of the 9/11 terror attacks, include using nationality to map neighbourhoods, gather informants, and search for spies. For reaction to the revisions, I spoke to Farhana Khera, the president of Muslim Advocates.
Well, we are still waiting to see the actual final guidance, but we are hopeful, and I am cautiously optimistic that the revised guidance is going to be a step forward. I think as your listeners may know, this guidance was first issued a little over 10 years ago, and it purported to ban racial and ethnic profiling, but actually had broad loopholes for border integrity and national security that really rendered the guidance toothless. And so there are a number of communities, Latinos, African Americans, the Muslim community, Arab community, Sikh community, who are affected by the lack of an effective ban on all forms of profiling. And given the Attorney General's public statements just yesterday, he recounted his own personal experience with being profiled by law enforcement and his commitment to, as he put it, the principle of unbiased policing. And so I certainly am encouraged by his words and am eagerly waiting to see what this final guidance looks like.
It perhaps would be an understatement to say that the relationship between the FBI and civil rights groups has been turbulent since, post 9/11 America.
Yeah, since 9/11, I think there definitely have been a number of concerns that civil rights organizations have raised with the FBI as it's changed its focus and orientation, and with advances in technology and all sorts of concerns that raises in terms of privacy and civil liberties, and what we believe to be an expanded reach of the FBI that goes beyond just looking at individuals where there's evidence of wrongdoing or following up on credible intelligence and legitimate leads, and expanding its effort to include kind of these broad-scale interviews of people simply based on their faith background or ethnicity, or collecting data on people. So there's a very full set of concerns that we have.
Farhana, you've said that expanding the rules beyond race to cover nationality and religion, that would be a positive step forward, but you're still apprehensive about the use of what the FBI calls domain mapping. Can you explain what we mean by that and why that's cause for concern.
With this domain mapping program that the FBI officially launched at the end of 2008, but that we suspect they were starting to put in place even before that, according to records obtained by the ACLU, the FBI has been collecting data and creating maps of different racial and ethnic communities around the United States, including Latinos, Asian communities, et cetera. So it's a concern that should be a concern to all Americans.
Methods that the FBI would argue are used in the fight against terrorism, and their removal perhaps would jeopardize that effort.
We certainly all care deeply about our safety and security, but I think what's important is that in order for law enforcement to do its job effectively, it needs to be focused on legitimate threats and credible intelligence. And it's not just civil rights advocates saying that, but even security experts, former Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff, since leaving office, has been quite outspoken against racial and religious profiling. The experts say that when you take your eye off the ball, so to speak, and you start focusing on generalized characteristics of a group of people who happen to share the same ethnic or faith background, it diverts precious law enforcement time and resources.
Farhana Kera, the president of Muslim Advocates. The United Nations Security Council has approved sending a full peacekeeping force to the Central African Republic following a year of religious-motivated violence. Thousands have been killed in fighting between Christian and Muslim groups, with the UN estimating 1.36 million people, nearly a third of the population, is now in need of assistance. Earlier, I spoke to Nick Harper at the UN headquarters in New York.
Yes, an important vote, and one that some at the United Nations feel should have happened a long time ago. The Secretary-General, Ban Ki-moon, has been pushing since the middle of last year to try and get a full peacekeeping mission in the country. The French as well, the old colonial power of CAR, have been pushing for some time. So we will be seeing 1,200 peacekeepers in the country. That'll be made up of 10,000 troops and around 2,000 police. They'll be taking over from the African Union force, who are currently on the ground. There's around 6,000 of them, but the 2,000 French troops that are in the country will remain, and they will work alongside the peacekeepers. All of this, diplomats are telling us, is good news. However, it will take some time for these peacekeepers to get on the ground. They won't officially take over from the African Union force until the middle of September, so there is still some time to go before the Blue Helmets are properly in the CAR.
And Nick, this approval for a UN peacekeeping course, it actually comes amid fresh reports of more deadly clashes.
That's right. On Wednesday, in the town of Dakoa, at least 30 people were killed and another 10 were injured. Many of them were civilians that were simply caught up in the crossfire, in the fighting between the Christians and the Muslims. And this is something that we've seen now for more than 12 months. Christians and Muslims pitted against each other, militia groups going around, effectively involved in a religious-motivated conflict. The big worry is, from many commentators, that what we're seeing in the CAR is similar to what we saw in Rwanda 20 years ago, when that country descended into genocide. Top officials at the United Nations have been warning for some time that there is a risk of genocide in CAR. And indeed, there's no definitive figure on exactly how many people have died in the last 12 months. The rough estimate is thousands, but there's no exact figure.
The situation in the CAR, it's been described as a tragedy of historic proportions. Can you give us some background on how this humanitarian crisis unfolded?
Well, yes, on a humanitarian level, the situation in the country has quite simply spiraled. In March 2013, we saw a coup. The president was overthrown and a Muslim rebel leader, Michel Djotobier, took control. In January this year, he realized that he wasn't able to get a handle on the situation and resigned. He left the country to escape. And since then, we've seen an upsurge in Christian militia targeting Muslim civilians, mainly in retaliation for what happened in this coup. Now, just a couple of days ago, the United Nations warned that a third of the entire population is in need of serious assistance. They're saying that around 1.6 million people are food insecure. Quite simply put, they don't have any food to eat. The fighting has forced many people from their homes, so it's meant that farmers have been unable to plant crops, and we're at a point where famine is a very real prospect. The peacekeepers will be able to help with the law and order side of things, but the situation in the country, some people are warning, will take years to try and rectify.
Now, NASA's decision to cut most of its contacts with Russia is being met with dismay by some veterans of America's space program. The US space agency's move last week was in response to the standoff with the Kremlin over Ukraine. Our US correspondent reports from Orlando near the Kennedy Space Center.
This is a prototype of one of the Russian spacesuits.
Showing off a vast collection of space memorabilia at his museum near the Kennedy Space Center, former NASA engineer Charlie Mars worked on every U.S. manned space program during the height of the space race with Russia.
Most of us were angry. We were angry that they had beat us. We were determined then to try and overcome that and get way ahead of them.
But since the U.S. space shuttle was retired in 2011, NASA now depends on Russia for rides into orbit. Russia's Soyuz craft is now the only way for U.S. astronauts to get to the International Space Station, at least until 2017, following recent budget cuts.
One of the Russian models.
Charlie Mars thinks NASA's decision to cut most of its links with Russia's space agency may backfire.
All of a sudden, Russia says, sorry, our borders are closed. So what are we going to do? It's going to be a Russian space station. They're the only ones right now that can really put men up there and bring them back.
But Rory O'Neill, a journalist covering the space industry, says despite severing ties with Russia in most areas of cooperation, NASA is making an exception for the International Space Station.
The space station is an international venture, so what the U.S. and Russia have done are very intertwined. Communication systems, power systems, even rides up to the International Space Station on Soyuz rockets are all interconnected, and you can't just pull that thread on a sweater and watch it unravel.
This is a model of the Saturn V.
NASA veterans say they believe the U.S. is now a long way from the glory days of Saturn, Mercury, and Apollo. And Charlie Mars fears the latest spat over Ukraine could deal a major setback to America's future adventures in space. Steve Mort, Orlando.
A public nuisance. Not a label you typically associate with a popular hot sauce, but that's the widely held opinion in one Californian city. The Irwindale City Council voted overwhelmingly on Wednesday to declare the spicy smell of sriracha hot sauce production an offence on the senses. People who live in the area say the odour from the plant burns their eyes, noses and throats, with some even claiming the chili condiment brought on nosebleeds. To find out how the hot sauce manufacturer intends to respond, I spoke to LA Times journalist Frank Shong.
Sriracha hot sauce is a hot sauce kind of born here in California, created by an immigrant, David Tran. And, you know, over the past couple of years, it's steadily grown in popularity and recently expanded to a factory in Irwindale, where they're having some problems with the city government there because residents are complaining about the smell that it gives off during production.
What exactly is their complaint? Because they've described this as a public nuisance.
Well, so during the pepper grinding season, which is about 2 to 3 months a year, and it starts in August, truckloads of peppers are coming in every day and just being ground up to form the base for the sauce. And that air is kind of vented out into the community, and people are complaining about, you know, it makes them cough. You know, people talked about having to move birthday parties indoors, and you know, children with asthma can't go outside, and just generally sort of aggravating certain health issues with throat breathing.
So what action is now being taken against the Sriracha company?
Well, the city has already sued Sriracha in Huifeng Foods, which is the name of the company. They've already been sued in Los Angeles Superior Court alleging public nuisance and breach of contract, and that trial is scheduled for November. They took this additional action, they say, as insurance, and this is sort of a city process in which they declare the factory a public nuisance and then adopt a resolution, and then within a couple of days they can be authorized to go in and make the changes themselves, 90 days.
Right, and has any solution been sort of offered by the plant as yet?
Well, the South Coast Air Quality Management District, which is sort of the pollution regulatory body over here, they've been working with the city and the factory to come up with solutions. And so they're looking at, you know, different types of filtration systems. You know, the company says they can solve the problem by June 1st, which is long before that deadline.
LA Times reporter Frank Xiong. And finally, as talk show legend David Letterman prepares to step down, his replacement, the man who'll take the Late Show throne, is announced.
You may be saying, Stephen, Americans have no vested interest here because according to a new Washington Post poll, only one out of six Americans can find Ukraine on a map. Although two did find Waldo. But the exact poll found the less Americans know about Ukraine's location, the more they want the U.S. to intervene. Damn straight, this is America, and we don't need to know where a country is to send troops there. Yeah.
Stephen Colbert, the host of Comedy Central's The Colbert Report, has beaten a host of rumored replacements to take the coveted CBS network role. For more on the appointment and what it'll mean for a post-Letterman Late Show, I spoke to Washington Post pop culture and TV blogger Emily Yar.
It happened very fast. Just last week, David Letterman announced that he was going to retire from The Late Show in 2015. And just a few days later, now CBS has signed Stephen Colbert to replace him. People know Stephen Colbert from his Comedy Central show, The Colbert Report. He's been on that since 2005, and his name had come up as someone who might replace Letterman, but I think people were very surprised it happened as fast as it did.
And he, as you said, his name was in the running. There were also some other big names rumored to be among possible replacements. Letterman, these are huge shoes to fill. But scanning some social media just before I began talking to you, I'm struggling to find much objection. This seems like a really popular choice.
Yeah, so far people seem to think it's a good fit. I mean, he's, I think, very similar to Letterman. Their senses of humor kind of fit together. They're just these very kind of quirky, sarcastic personalities. So people seem to think it's a good choice. I mean, one thing that you have to note is that Colbert isn't going to be bringing his sort of faux conservative character over from Comedy Central. He's just going to be on The Late Show acting as himself. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
And what happens to the void left behind by the Colbert Report? What have we got any ideas yet of what they might do there?
I don't know. It's definitely a wide field. I mean, some names that are already coming up. Chelsea Handler, she has a late night show on E! And she's said to be looking to leave that soon. So people are thinking that she might be a good fit for Comedy Central's brand. And people also kind of want to see a woman in one of these prominent late-night spots. So I think she's a name that's coming up. There were some other floated around when Letterman was leaving, but I think that's probably the biggest name you'll see.
Washington Post pop culture and TV blogger Emily Yar. And that's the Thursday edition of FSN Reports. Coming up on Friday, we head to South Africa as a week of emotional testimony from Blade Runner Oscar Pistorius comes to a close. That's Friday. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington alongside producer Simon Marks and Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone with feature story news everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.